When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAPS sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked, board-certified plastic surgeons, from tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond. Every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Bite into a stacked sandwich made with Hero Bread, and the only thing you'll think is, delicious. You won't think it has up to 19 grams protein, 11 to 32 grams of fiber, or just 0 to 5 grams net carbs. But it does. Hero Bread. No compromises, just loaves, buns, tortillas, bagels, and noodles packed with flavor. Right now, get 10% off at hero.co with code IHEART. That's hero.co, code IHEART. All figures per serving of Hero Bread. See nutrition facts on hero.co.
Hi, this is PodSave the UK. I'm Coco Khan.
And I'm Sophie Duca.
So attentive listeners and watchers will notice that Sophie is not, in fact, Nish Kumar.
No, but I am still a black/brown person that makes bigots angry.
We didn't want to lower the diversity count, you see.
Oh, no, of course, yeah.
No.
Curly hair? Big thoughts.
So Sophie is stepping in the hot seat this week while Nish is off having a break, which is good because he doesn't take breaks, an aside. Sophie is a comedian and writer. She's performed at the likes of Live at the Apollo, Mock the Week, and she's actually won both Taskmaster and Celebrity Mastermind. Here's a taster of Sophie at work.
I know some people don't like it when you talk about identities. They don't like it when gay comedians talk about gay stuff, or women comics talk about girl stuff, or Croatian comedians bang on about Croatia. But if I don't talk about my pain on stage, how else will I make my therapy tax deductible?
What a little cutie. Monetize the trauma.
Right, so Sophie, brace yourself. It is not a light week to be cutting your teeth on a politics podcast. On the show today, we're asking, genuinely asking, is this World War III as conflict escalates across the Middle East?
Yes, it's bleak. And as oil prices surge because of this conflict, inflation will too, which is bad news for a chancellor who has just delivered her spring statement on the economy.
Okay, so first up, the small task of catching you all up on World War III. So on Saturday, all eyes turned to Iran after the United States and Israel launched a full-blown attack on the country. The Ayatollah Khomeini, that's Iran's supreme leader for the last 37 years, was killed along with senior figures from the regime.
And before the world had time to absorb that shock, Iran retaliated, launching a barrage of strikes targeting Israeli and American bases across the Gulf, including Qatar, Kuwait, Jordan, the UAE and Bahrain, as well as some civilian locations like hotels.
So far, the Iranian Red Crescent Society has estimated that more than 1,000 people have been killed in Iran since the conflict began. Among them were 165 schoolgirls and staff after a primary school was bombed, the worst mass casualty so far. Meanwhile, influencers in Doha and Dubai turned war correspondents, capturing bombs raining down over luxury skylines.
This situation is moving extremely quickly. As we record on Wednesday, there are overnight reports of explosions across Iran and Lebanon from Israeli strikes, and Iran has continued to carry out drone attacks. An emergency evacuation flight is due to leave from Oman tonight, but thousands of Britons are thought to be stuck in the region. And, as we'll discuss later, the economic consequences of this war are already being felt globally.
So initially, Keir Starmer had refused to let the US use British bases to bomb Iran. But on Sunday, the Prime Minister changed tack, posting this recorded statement saying that there would be some support, but only in a limited way.
The United States has requested permission to use British bases for that specific and limited defensive purpose. We have taken the decision to accept this request.
My God, it's like describing specific defensive
and limited.
I was like, are you talking about how you speak? You speak to us, to the public.
Specific and very precisely.
And extremely defensive, because you know this is very bad, what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's him doing a U-turn and being like, yeah, well, we will actually. Yeah, well, yeah, now they've asked twice, we'll just allow them to use British bases. I mean, obviously, this is something that pleases no one, but he's not managing to stand strong against Trump. He's not fulfill it. Like, Trump's disappointed with him because he's not, you know, out to destroy all of the Middle East and giving him carte blanche on everything. It just feels like a sort of tail between his legs admission that he's essentially being pressured into something that is abhorrent.
Oh, goodness me. And, you know, like, he cannot pretend that he wasn't to know how controversial this would be. He's being hammered in pretty much all directions. So the Greens, Lib Dems and some Labour backbenchers have been saying quite vocally, quite publicly, that all of this should have been put to a vote in Parliament. Donald Trump slammed him for not moving fast enough, though. And it sort of seems that despite those plethora of voices versus the single voice of Donald Trump, we sort of get the sense about which was more powerful. So in an interview with The Sun, Trump lamented the fact that the special relationship was not like it used to be. And he later said, "This is not Winston Churchill we're dealing with."
Starmer is feeling the pressure, however, as Trump threatened to cut all trade with Spain after, unlike the UK, their PM Pedro Sanchez refused to let the US use its airbases. In response to the president's catty comments, Starmer had this to say at PMQs.
"What I was not prepared to do on Saturday was for the UK to join a war unless I was satisfied there was a lawful basis and a viable thought-through plan. That remains my position."
Now, Starmer has been at pains to insist that the UK involvement in US strikes on Iran is defensive. Now, this is obviously an extremely blurry line. What is clear, though, is that, like it or not, Britain is now very much involved in this chaos. So on Sunday, a British RAF base on Cyprus was struck by a drone. And on Tuesday, the government confirmed it is sending a Navy warship to defend it.
Now, if, like me, you need just a moment to figure out how we got here in the first place, our special guest, Sanam Naraghi Andalini, is here to help.
Sanam is a peace strategist, founder and CEO of the International Civil Society Action Network, or ICAN. She's Iranian-British, she's a commentator on Iran, and has spent nearly three decades working on global conflicts and peacebuilding. She was awarded an MBE for her services to international peacebuilding and women's rights, and was an architect of the UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace and security. She also has a podcast, by the way, it's called If You Were in Charge. So she's basically your classic woman underachiever. Welcome to Pod Save the UK,
Sanam. Thank you very much.
I really wish we had you on this show in better circumstances. There's clearly so much you could talk about. I do just want to ask you, how are you? How are your family? I know you still have family in Iran. This must be scary.
Thank you very much for having me. We have a little meme going around in Farsi that says, "I'm okay, but don't ask me how I am because I will cry." And I think that that's really the state that we're all in. You wake up in the morning and, you know, you go on your social media and you hear that B-52 bombers, which are these gigantic monsters of planes that drop. I don't really understand the military, you know, 170,000 tons, you know, like these things that it's all the military gizmo stuff. But it's these gigantic planes dropping gigantic bombs that are now, they have shockwaves in a city of 15 million people. They've bombed 10 hospitals already, neonatal units, schools. 181 kids under the age of 10 have already been documented as having died. Over 1,000 civilians have already died. We don't know how many soldiers. And in Iran, you know, Iran has the old-fashioned draft. So it's just, you know, if you're 18, 19 years old as a boy, you get sent off to the barracks. And we don't know how many of them have been killed. So this morning I woke up and I was like, I wish it was yesterday morning. And the day before and the day before. So that's how it is for us right now.
We have the comfort in the UK of not having necessarily felt war directly. But what you've described there is that essentially every single citizen will know someone affected by this.
Absolutely, because this is an illegal war, whatever that means. You know, no war is ever good. But we've had situations where the Security Council gets together and they make some determination that, you know, we have to go to war. Often very circumspect and dodgy. But in this particular case, there is no agreement. It was a preemptive strike. There was no reason for it. All of the rationale that they gave of nuclear weapons, it's all false. And everybody's coming out and saying it was false. And there were, in the middle of negotiations between the United States and Iran with the Omani foreign minister, and the night before the bombing started, in a very unprecedented way, he came out on American television to say, "We're very close to a deal. They have made concessions. You know, we're just ironing out the details." And then the next morning, the bombing started. So that's one side of the sort of story. And then the other side of it has been that the Israelis have been working with the Shah's son, Reza Pahlavi, who lives in America. He's 66. He's actually never had a job, but, you know, what's that? Who needs qualifications to run a country? But he has been almost like a Pied Piper for Iranians to say, you know, we're going to have freedom. We need the West to come and help us. We need this military attack because we're going to have freedom. And so, you know, lots of people who are desperate and, you know, both in Iran and outside are like, yes, yes, we rally around. We want the military attacks. Assuming that they would be sort of targeted at the heads of the regime, you know, a little bit like kind of Venezuela style kind of decapitation, as they call it. Completely a misunderstanding the nature of the Iranian state, which is much more complex, but even more so, completely being hoodwinked by what the Israeli agenda was and has been for many, many years in the region, which is expansionist. And so 4 days into the war, we're now seeing that they are targeting things like police stations and the infrastructure of governance of the state. So, you know, banks are closed. People can't get their money out. Passport offices are closed. People are trying to leave can't, you know. Yesterday we heard from someone saying they've hit the police station, so the policemen are out in the streets. You know, so you're creating a sense of statelessness, right? That of absolute chaos, because they want the country to be fragmented. And this is just 4 days in. So that's one side. And then the Iranian regime has been retaliating, and they are fighting the might of the American military power. And so their strategy from the beginning, and they said, if you come at us, we will come at your bases. So they've been targeting the American military bases, some economic infrastructure. Like the Americans moved their soldiers from bases to hotels. And so they targeted the hotels, right? So they're trying to inflict both economic pain and militarily kind of cause some damage. And then our government suddenly gets involved. And this is where I'm like, what are we doing? This is an illegal war. There are war crimes being committed in Iran by the Israelis and the Americans. We are putting our own troops at risk. For what? Why are we signing up to this nonsense and this travesty? Because this is just, as I say, 4 days in, and this is the situation we're in.
Israel and the US have said that the strikes were preventative, meaning that they were to prevent Iran from developing a capacity to be a threat. There used to be claims about the country's nuclear capabilities, but what is the actual truth about these threats from Iran?
I am no fan of the Iranian regime. I came to England because they were persecuting my family. So it's not that I have an affinity at all with the state. I just think that when you go to war against a country of 93 million people, you need to understand, first of all, what is the nature of the state and why, and what is it that you're doing and what are the consequences of that. And the question of the nuclear weapons was, they didn't have it. They haven't had it. The IAEA, the UN body that deals with atomic energy and weapons, has again categorically come out and said that they didn't have anything. And frankly, if you remember in June, the Israelis and the Americans bombed Iran, and they said it's, you know, whatever capacity for enriching uranium, et cetera, has been disabled. So that's the basic, there's a lie that is being floated around, and it's very similar to Iraq 2003.
But even if that was true, am I right in thinking that waging war to prevent something happening, that's not allowed?
That's not allowed, no.
It's, no, yeah, because getting a bit Minority Report, yeah, that, isn't, yeah, it? Like, yeah, oh, you might commit a crime, right, so now we will inflict harm,
right,
on you,
that's,
and
right,
all your
citizens. That's right. You might come and rob me blind, so I'm going to come and kill you first. I mean, it doesn't, that's not really how it works. The other thing from a UK standpoint, which really upsets me, is that we sit on this UN Security Council as a permanent member. You know, there are 5 permanent members and 10 that roll in every 2 years. It's the UK, the US, China, Russia, and France. The United Nations was created at the end of World War II with the premise of giving us some international infrastructure for international law, prevention of war, to prevent the scourge of war for future generations. That's what the essence is. The Security Council is the body that's meant to do it. Like, we sit with the greatest responsibility for the prevention of war and upholding international law. We're meant to be the firemen, not the arsonists. And what are we doing, kind of enabling all of this? And you know, the UN didn't come out of just, oh, somebody had a good idea at the end of World War II. It was 500 years of human history of thinking about how do you, you know, put guardrails around how we treat each other and nations and powerful nations and war, you know, sort of might versus versus law. 500 years, millions and millions of people dying, two world wars, to finally get to this international system that we've all benefited from. The level of irresponsibility is just extraordinary. And we have to ask why? Why are we doing this? Who's benefiting? What's the end game? What are the risks? And you know, let's talk about it before we just make the decision to join in.
This podcast is brought to you by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe.
When it comes to sending money abroad, many providers claim to offer free fees and competitive rates, but don't be fooled. This can just be code for inflated exchange rates.
With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive money in over 40 currencies without ever having to worry about hidden fees.
Sending pounds across the pond, most transfers arrive in 20 seconds or less.
Spending Riyaj in Rio, the Wise travel card gives you the mid-market rate on every purchase. No costly markups on your bill.
Getting paid in dollars for your side gig? Well, avoid hidden fees and get the real exchange rate every time.
With 24/7 access to live support, your international transactions with Wise are quick, transparent, and safe. Plus, Wise runs over 7 million daily checks to catch and prevent fraud.
15 million people already trust Wise to manage their money internationally. Be smart, get Wise. Nish, you know all about international travel, given where you are right now. How's that going with your money management down under?
Listen, it's very complicated and very difficult. You need as much help as you can possibly get. Wise simplifies this entire process for you. We've also got family that live abroad. This is a really helpful tool for that as well.
Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. PodSave the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
Starting something new isn't just hard, it's also terrifying. So much work goes into this thing and you're never sure if it's going to work out. It can be really hard to make that leap of faith. Whatever you're doing, whether you're starting a business or if, like us, as we were a couple of years ago, starting a podcast, you're never really sure what you're doing. You know, you're asking yourself questions like, what if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if Coco asks me about how I sit down and that inspires a YouGov poll, which is really something that happened within the first year of this podcast. The way that I sit down was put to a focus group and polled. The important thing is to believe in yourself and also have the right tools to support you. And that's why it can help you to have a partner like Shopify on your side.
So Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from household names like Mattel to Gymshark to brands just getting started. They have all sorts of tools to help you, although I don't know if they can help with your sitting posture, Nish. Just for clarity, he sits down hard. He throws himself down. I like to do an elegant perch, me.
Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling.
And if you're asking, what if people haven't heard about my brand? Well, Shopify helps you find your customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns.
It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today.
Sign up for your £1 per month trial today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
That's shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk. I had the misfortune yesterday of having to, I don't know why I do this, I'm clearly a masochist, but sometimes I go into right-wing spaces to like talk about the news. and you know, I'm there talking about international law, you know, good, isn't it? Isn't it good that we have it? We should try and stick to it. And people talking to you like you're a hippie idiot who doesn't understand the way that the world is. And actually, by the time you go to the Security Council, bad people could have come. And anyway, and it's really made me feel that we've lost sense about the sort of world that we want to live in. Like, I don't want to live in a world where might is right. I mean, we're a small nation. It's not a good look for us to live in that world because we will be kicked around. I mean, you could argue that we are being kicked around at the moment anyway. It's the same with the situation with Gaza, you know. I had the I went to go see a talk by the writer, the political thinker Eche Temokuran, and she talked about Gaza being a rehearsal. They want to see what they can get away with, and it's sort of coming true, isn't it? Like they got away with that. They're going to get away with this. Well, what do we do about it?
It's interesting. Yeah, Eche is a good friend of mine, and so we talk about all these things, and it's true. You know, so what we saw in Gaza is now being played out in Iran. So day one, they targeted a girls' school, an elementary school, you know, little girls. 108 little girls were killed. Immediately, they said, oh, it wasn't us. It was a failed, you know, Iranian missile, right? And the journalists and all the, you know, investigative folks are now clued in. So immediately, people were doing geospatial things and saying, no, that missile that you're showing is you know, thousands of miles away. It's got nothing to do with the geography of this place. Essentially disproving them. So then they said, oh, it's somebody else. And these stories get circulated that it was themselves, they did it deliberately, it wasn't us, but it was them. And then they did 10 hospitals. And at some point you're like, either you have targeted, sophisticated targeted weapons that can target, you can explode whatever beepers in the pockets of Hezbollah guys, right? Either you have that sophistication or you don't. We suspect that you do, and therefore you are targeting these sites. They targeted a heritage site. We have the Golestan Palace in Tehran. It's got this hall of mirrors. It's from the 18th century. You know, it's been destroyed largely, right? So they do this deliberately. They did it in Gaza. And the other thing that we saw in Gaza, which is now being practiced in Iran, is that they will hit a civilian site. People will come out to help people. And then they'll drop another, as people come to help, they drop another bomb. And it's got a name. It's called Double Tap. So this is what is going on. The reason why Gaza is so important is that we fell for the propaganda, and it's drawn us into being aiding and abetting and enabling genocide. And I don't want to be that. I don't want to sort of say, I came to the UK, I had to become a refugee when I was a kid from a revolution, and I've gone from having been a refugee to now enabling and aiding genocide with my taxes, or, you know, here in America or wherever it is. I think we should, at least let's have a vote. Let's have a referendum or something to say, do we want to or not? You know, something like that, because these are also all of our resources that are going.
Yeah, and it's not just the moral repugnance of genocide, obviously. You know, they trot out this line that, oh, you know, Iran's a hotbed of terrorism. So it's like, you bombed a little girl's school. You just made a load of terrorists, you know. Like,
no, and also, who is the terrorist?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what is terrorism, right? If it's about invoking terror, what are we doing? And it all goes back, you know, literally it all goes back to the question of Palestine, because while all this is happening in the West Bank, they have been terrorizing people to, you know, and the settlers are there and they're trying to take that land and they're trying to annex it. So making us chase over here and seeing this sort of horror show, meanwhile, they're doing something else over there. And it's been framed as anti-Semitism, if we criticize it. This has got nothing to do with Judaism. This is about a political ideology of what I call extreme Zionism, of an expansionist state political ideology. It's got nothing to do with faith. We have Jews living in Iran, 50 synagogues that have been always active. You know, it's got nothing to do with that. But they framed it like that so that they scare us into being silent. And at some point, you just can't be. You have to speak up. We have a responsibility to say, what is going on and how? Why are we getting dragged into this?
What you said about terror and who is the terrorist, and also about international law, it feels like the strategy has no end game other than to cause that sort of destruction and chaos. It feels like it's almost desirable to kind of like bypass the formalities and exercise that strength. And here in the UK, when we're being like, why is our government involved with this? It doesn't feel like there's any sort of resistance to that ideology. It feels that Starmer put up a pretense of not going along with it for a while. And then now it's just kind of like, okay, as long as there's the flimsiest convenient lie for why we should be associated, we'll go along with it.
If I put aside my ethics, love saying that, put those aside for a second. Britain not standing up to America and saying, we don't want to be dragged into another illegal war. We've already done this before. It played very, very badly for us. In fact, it kept our government, kept our party out of office for nearly 14 years. And we're in a really bad place. We're not going to do that again. But there's this idea that we have to do it so that we get special treatment. But then you look at the tariffs and we didn't get special treatment. And then you look at big tech and how it's destroying our country. And we don't get any treatment where we can try and legislate or regulate against them because we're told that we can't do that and we should sit down and behave. Is this just Iraq all over again? Is this just a repeat of history?
It's a combination of things. So from the Middle Eastern standpoint, it is absolutely Iraq all over again. And I wrote about this in 2019 because, every once in a while, there's like the drums of war, of going to war with Iran. And we would, I lived in America and it was like, lots of voices pulling it back and saying in diplomacy, et cetera. But imagine this. Imagine that Iraq had turned into a viable democracy governance. They had the oil. They would be a rich country. They had educated people. It could be a powerhouse in the region, legitimate political powerhouse. What would they do on the question of Palestine? Would they turn a blind eye and say, "Oh, we don't mind what Israel is doing," or would they actually stand up and stand as a kind of bulwark against what Israel was doing? So, it's to their benefit that Iraq turned into a mess. Same playbook in Syria. Same playbook in Libya. And it's, in a way, it's been three countries that have benefited. So Israel, because it can do whatever it wants. UAE, which became the economic powerhouse, and then also militarily, they started to sort of, trying to push their weight around in places like Yemen. And then Saudi Arabia has been interesting because Saudi Arabia, for a number of years, was exporting really extreme jihadi sort of Wahhabism, basically. The Saudis then have realized that this kind of extremism isn't to their benefit. So now they're trying to sort of reform and go in a different direction. And being in the region, they understand that for them to benefit, to prosper, the neighborhood has to be prosperous as well. So there is an alignment between the Iran and Saudi and the Gulf states and so forth. I also worry about the fact that we are in debt right now economically, and we have housing problems, education problems, healthcare problems, all sorts of things that are relate to our human security as a nation, right? And instead, we are borrowing from the future £60 billion to build up weapons, most of which are only genuinely useful if they remain useless. Because if we start, 40 new nuclear warheads, how many of them do we need to use before we're all obliterated, right? So we're putting our money there. It's in private hands. We don't really know. Public money is going into private weapons companies. And we're just being told, this is national security. But nothing is being done for climate resilience, for environmental resilience, as I say, for healthcare, for kids that are coming out of COVID with mental health issues and, insecurity in our communities. But it's, we're just being told to, stick with it, basically. And that bothers me because who's going to pay the cost of that in the future? And the global military budget this year is around $3 trillion. That's how much we're spending on weaponry. But the cost of violence, the actual, like all this devastation that's happened in Ukraine and Gaza and now Iran, it is something like $19 trillion just last year. $19 trillion of destruction.
Yeah. The kind of psychological landscape of people, both in the Middle East and in diaspora, is completely decimated. The infrastructure is in tatters and the real cost and the real wins are so minuscule compared to, the overarching devastation.
But it's the people who devastate rarely feel the repercussions,
exactly.
Isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, somebody said today I was reading something and they say, the cost, it's going to be a high cost for this. And I'm like, what cost are you paying? The first people that paid are the 108 little girls who died and their families. Like, you make a decision over here and people are dying over there and generations are impacted. And we move on. Maybe this war will last 10 days. Maybe it's two weeks. The news cycle will change. So these are the kinds of things that keep me up at night and make me really
cross.
Upset. Yeah.
Oh, I know. I've been feeling really raging recently. I also this is a slight sidebar, but I really had enough of just men who think about geopolitics like it's football. Yeah. Stop war gaming. Just stop sitting around being like, well, actually, I think this. Like, well, stop it. It's not you who's going to get shot, is it? Anyway,
unfortunately,
it's also really sort of extraordinary that leadership is kind of you know, it's as if you go and bomb, you're a leader. But if you sit down and talk, oh, you're weak. And I'm like, you're sitting behind your desk ordering a bunch of kids to go and kill and be killed and maim and be maimed. You know, how strong is that? Like, what
it's
kind of
like
strength is
Trump
that?
Trump was saying that, Keir, it's not exactly Winston Churchill we're dealing with. And it's like, why would you want to be like Winston Churchill? Yeah. Like, why is this the icon? Like, yeah. I mean, not luckily, like, Keir Starmer is not a Winston Churchill, but like, you want to be like this sort of like, a like callous, arguably white supremacist man, like just known for his like,
I mean, I can't even begin to start scratching the surface of the white supremacy that is involved in this. But before we let you go, there is these war gaming men. They trot out this line, which is that, like, fundamentally, it is America that keeps us safe. So to stay safe, we must follow America, which I find a very depressing thought and also feels a little bit almost like defeatist in many respects. I understand there are actually a number of routes that could be taken to de-escalate this, and the government are choosing not to. I wonder if you could just outline some of those so that the next time we are confronted with this argument, we can say, well, actually, no, you could do this, 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 this.
So first of all, the question of America leading, and again, like, is America leading for its own interests, or is it being dragged in by various other interests? That's important. But let me give you an example. So they went into Iran, either the Americans or the Israelis, that they're now arguing about who did it, but they go and they assassinate Khamenei, the supreme leader, in his compound. He sat in his compound and knew that this was going to happen. This is a man who didn't have genuinely much of a stature and aura in life. 86 years old, has cancer, would have eventually dropped off somehow, you know, like you do. By assassinating him, they sort of elevated his status to imamhood, to martyrdom. What happened there? In Iraq, in the network of what I work with women peace builders in all these places. So as the men are going rah-rah with their guns, I'm dealing with the women who are actually dealing with the consequences and trying to mitigate these. Immediately, we heard in Iraq, in Pakistan, in Kashmir, in Lebanon, that people are rallying because he was, you know, a figurehead for them. He was some kind of spiritual leader. And because he was assassinated, it's almost a sense of revenge. So you have all these people now who are, it's a new generation who is anti-American. If we join in it, they're going to be anti-British. They have, in Pakistan, they've already gone and raided, you know, sort of the American embassy in Iraq as well. And the ripple effect of that, right? That's already happening in one, but it spreads. So the consequences of our actions aren't being considered. The second thing is, if you are worried about a country having nuclear weapons, we have the systems in place to monitor. We have something called the NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is actually a signatory to that. Israel is not, by the way, right? So we have that. They had an agreement, the original nuclear deal that was signed in 2015, they had inspections on a regular basis. The whole thing was under surveillance. They had cameras, they had people going in to observe and so forth. So we were actually using the rule of law to contain, and it was much cheaper than going and bombing. Iran is a country of 93 million people. You do this, you don't think that we're going to have refugee flows coming out? You don't think that the remnants, whatever the regime is, as they fight, like the Taliban did for 20 years, you don't think that they're going to, I don't know, start producing opium that's going to hit our markets here and cause also another opiate crisis? I mean, it's not a vacuum that we go into. And I think one of the things that really gets me is that there is always a perception, I think it's laced with deep racism in some ways, that we look at these countries over there and we just think that they're stupid brown people or stupid mullahs, whatever the tropes are that they use. We seem to sort of lurch from war to war. And as I say, each time this happens, there's an uptick in the profits of weapons industry. And it's like, how much is that tied with our politicians these days? I don't know, but I do know that the lobbying that the weapons industry is doing is here and in Europe and in America.
Do you think it could spread to, people are saying World War III? Do you think that's a reasonable?
So your question about de-escalation, I think that we're at this bizarre crossroads because the Israeli agenda is to cause to cause kind of chaos and the fragmentation of Iran and to be able to expand regionally. They're also about to send something like 100,000 troops into Lebanon at the moment, right? So that's their interest. The American interest, it keeps changing. The Iranian logic, it's asymmetrical warfare. And asymmetrical warfare, you know, they're fighting the regime. They're fighting an existential fight. So for them, so long as they survive and so long as they're doing some harm, they are winning, right? So they might escalate. The Iranian people want a different government altogether. But in the meantime, as the war started, it's been hardened. So Khamenei gets killed. The assembly of whatever clerics get together to vote in the new supreme leader. And guess who they bring? His son. His son. He is the most despised person in Iran. And he would never have gotten this position if things had gone, you know, the natural political course, because he had many adversaries inside the system. But they've just voted him to be the guy. At the moment, we're in this fervor of, like, the fever rising, and that the consequences are really, really profound.
Salem, thank you so much for joining us on Pod Save the UK. So if you want more on what is going on and what the hell are the US and Israel up to, head over to our sister podcast, Pod Save the World, where Tommy and Ben break down the latest. After the break, has the Middle East conflict made Rachel Reeves' spring statement even more obsolete?
Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Surfshark.
Now, I'm just going to be upfront here and say I use a VPN. Now, people can make of that what they will. Some may think it's for streaming of countries and content that I am not entitled to. That is your belief.
I would never say that. I would never believe such a thing.
But there are actually loads of different reasons for a VPN. And one that I think gets overlooked quite a lot is about security. If you're someone like me that is chased around with personalized ads and actually finds it genuinely quite chilling that you've been looking at something or talking about something and then it appears in your ads, then actually a VPN can really bring you a little bit more peace, particularly if you've ever had the experience of, like, I don't know, a breakup or even some sort of loss in your life and then the ads still keep coming in. You know, I find it can be genuinely upsetting. So make your digital life happier with a Surfshark VPN.
Yeah, and there's loads of benefits for having a VPN. For example, you mentioned security, Coco. Mm-hmm. You never have to worry about using an unsecured cafe, airport, or hotel network again, because Surfshark encrypts your connection to protect your personal details and financial data from hackers.
There's also unlimited devices, so you can secure your entire household. You can also just secure it across your many devices. We often have more than one now, so it's just a little bit of peace of mind. So unlike competitors, a single Surfshark account will cover every device you own, so PCs, phones, tablets, smart TVs, etc., etc. And we also want to mention Surfshark Alert. It's a monitoring tool that notifies you immediately if your email or passwords appear in any breach database. So altogether, you can just have a much happier, calmer, safer online experience. Go to surfshark.com/podsave or use code podsave, that's PODSAVE, at checkout to get 4 extra months of Surfshark VPN. That's surfshark.com/podsave, code podsave. Try it risk-free with their 30-day money-back guarantee.
Your country's in big trouble.
The world is a pretty confusing place right now.
How long have you known about Andrew and Epstein?
I'm Neil Paterson, and after 20 years reporting and presenting for Sky News, one thing's become clear. People don't just want to know what's happened. They want to know why. Our new daily podcast takes one story at a time, explains what's really going on, and why you need to know. This is Why. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, let's talk about something a lot of us deal with, thinning hair or hair loss. If that sounds familiar, CAPS has solutions. Their hair restoration treatments are personalized, designed to strengthen your existing hair, encourage regrowth, and improve scalp health. The providers at CAPS guide you every step of the way with advanced treatments for noticeable, long-lasting results. And when you book your first hair restoration appointment, you'll get a $50 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Book today at experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Now, chancellors don't tend to be a very cheery lot. Even when the news is good, there's never quite enough money to do everything the country needs. But Rachel Reeves must have been feeling quite chipper while preparing for her spring statement over the past few weeks.
Borrowing was down, fiscal headroom was up, and there was generally less fuss and bother about its content compared to last year's autumn budget, which was, if we're being totally honest, a complete mess from beginning to end.
So as she stood up in the Commons, she must have been absolutely cursing Trump, who managed to ruin all her nicely prepared facts and figures with his ego war in the Middle East.
It all happened too late to include in her statement. There just wasn't enough time to rip it up and start again. So she still had to go through with it and, in true Chancellor style, delivered her speech with all the energy of a deflated balloon.
This is the right plan. A plan that is more necessary than ever before in the world of uncertainty. A stronger and more secure economy. Inflation and interest rates falling. Resilient public finances, and in every part of Britain, working people better off.
Yeah. Did you feel moved?
I felt stirred. I felt shaken and stirred by her saying absolutely nothing.
Is it time for the news klaxon? Sound of our life leaving our bodies.
It's just sort of conveniently ignoring the reality of what's happening. Yeah. Not only does it not take into account the biggest news story of the week, but also she's just sort of edited it to be like, oh, unemployment is on the right, but we're just not going to talk about that.
Yeah.
There's nothing to pick her up on because she doesn't talk about anything that's actually currently important to people.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there were no policies for us to even really dissect. It almost felt like she was just essentially verbalising a graph. And what she wanted us to take from the graph was that things were getting better. But I think that it forgets the fact that things are really, really bad. So yes, okay, the analysis says that the families will be better off to the tune of £1,000 a year, which, don't get me wrong, £1,000 a year is a lot, but also families are really struggling by significantly more than that. Even when she talks about inflation rates and it's not rising as fast as people think, I mean, you know, the average person doesn't want to see any inflation at all. Economists are happy with 2% because they're like, oh, that won't spook the markets. But fundamentally, like, you know, I don't want to see anything go up. I expect that the Labour Party will feel positive about this speech because it's the first time in a while they've been able to say anything that's like vaguely good. But I did wonder if actually even us as journalists, like tuning in for it was pointless because the whole speech was actually just about her talking to her backbenchers saying, stick with us, we're not so bad. She made a couple of digs at reform, which you would expect. There's a lot of like unrest within the Labour Party. And I wonder if actually, it probably wasn't for the public, probably wasn't for journalists, there wasn't much to say, but saying to other Labour people, stick with us, kid.
Yeah, we're okay.
It's going in the right direction. And then, of course, we have this background note of doom because of gas and oil prices. So everything she said and all the plans could be turned completely on their head because of what's going on. So here's a lovely question for you for your debut on a politics podcast. Why are oil and gas prices surging, Sophie?
Why are oil and gas prices surging? Are you familiar with the Strait of Hormuz? Because I was not prior to coming on this podcast, but it is where 20% of the world's oil and gas passes through. So it's a key route for this. And Iran controls the land on the north of the Narrow Sea Passage, has already attached ships in the area. This entire oil and gas route has immediately become incredibly spicy. Ships in the area were told that the strait was closed after the first Israeli attacks. And this didn't count as a legal formal notice, but the risk of attack means that all ships have just stopped where they are. So that's at least 150 tankers at anchor in the Straits of Hormuz area.
I, like you, did not know that much about the Strait of Hormuz. I yearn for I was joking with Nish in a couple of episodes ago where I, like, because we live in such political times and obviously doing this job, I see politics everywhere. I went past a wine bar that said, like, free Prosecco on the chalkboard and I thought, who's in prison? Is Prosecco a political prisoner? And there was a time in my life someone would have said Strait of Hormuz and I would have been like, great drag name. But now, sadly,
no.
I know it's the centre of a political crisis that could draw us all into World War III. I miss the innocent times. I miss it.
That's so beautiful. I'm just thinking about Strait of Hormuz and like they're at sashay away. Sashay down the strait. It's
so good. It could be so good. R.I.P. Strait of Hormuz.
One of the big questions hanging over these forecasts and financial planning is, with an aging population, how many people will actually be working and paying tax? Because we're told that the recent fall in net migration and the decrease we are expecting this year could derail all of the Chancellor's nice little sums.
Net migration is the level once everyone coming to the UK and everyone leaving the UK is tallied up. So we will get the numbers for 2025 in May, but experts are predicting that it could be well short of the level that fed into the economic forecast that the Chancellor was talking about this week.
And what this essentially means is we don't have enough working age people. If people want to have a richer country, then we need to have an active workforce. And unless all the boomers start working into their 80s, that means migrants.
I can't believe you crossed your fingers at boomers
I want to see boomers earning their pay.
Yeah, that's what you really want.
I love a boomer in the workplace. They've never been responsible for any complications whatsoever.
It would be very challenging for me because obviously, you know, being of South Asian heritage, there'd just be this really uncomfortable moment where I go to a coffee shop and I ask this pensioner to make me a coffee and then they make it wrong. And then I'll be like, sit down, auntie, I'll make the coffee
and then I'll go back there.
It's not going to work. Let them retire.
Let them rest.
So what makes it even more infuriating is that the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, seems to have decided that the only good migration figure is zero, maybe even negative zero if she could get away with it. She's pushing on with her crackdown, this time announcing new measures to the asylum system, which kicked in on Monday.
Basically, the length of leave to remain for successful asylum seekers has been cut in half from 5 years to 2.5. It sounds straightforward, but as friend of the pod, the immigration expert Zoe Gardner explained on Instagram, it really, really isn't.
Its actual impact is going to be disastrous and stupid. Because when a country is dangerous enough that you have to escape it and you would qualify as a refugee, that means it's probably going to be dangerous for a while. That's usually just how things are.
Give it 2.5 years. It'll calm down.
God. I find myself, you know that meme of the woman doing maths?
Oh, yeah.
The confused woman doing math.
Yeah.
I'm the confused woman doing math all the time. And I think also part of it is, you must forgive me because I do sound like I've been smoking something, but like, it's all connected, man. It's all connected. You know, we're talking about Iran, and obviously there's going to be a influx of Iranian refugees, and they're doing all these political theatre of saying, like, we're trying to liberate the people of Iran, but you haven't given them refugee status. So it's all happening.
Yeah, you've given permission to destabilise thousands of people, a conservative guess, and then you're not going to let them in. And it sounds good to be like, we've cut it in half. Or what a wonderful 50%, but it doesn't take into account any of the logistics of actually living or settling or recovering from fleeing a country.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, part of us all accepting that other human beings live in a way that none of us would find acceptable is because we essentially have to swallow this idea that certain groups, certain races deserve less, are barbaric, they are from chaotic places, they can't run themselves. Anyway, it's been stressing me out, mate.
Mahmood is also this month going to stop all student visas from Afghanistan, Myanmar, Cameroon and Sudan this month due to what she calls widespread abuse.
I wasn't aware that there was widespread abuse of student visas from students from Myanmar.
Yeah.
That feels like that's just... Anyway, let's try and remember that sometimes good things do happen. Mm-hmm. Feels like a long time ago. But last week, Hannah Spencer's Green Party. I know. That feels like ages ago, doesn't it? Hannah Spencer's Green Party victory. They had victory in the Gorton and Denton by-election. So that's great. We love to see a progressive win here on Pod Save the UK. And Hannah really does seem to offer something distinct from the usual run of politicians. So please do make sure you check out her interview. We interviewed her on this show. It was amazing. It was so great to speak to someone who's clearly authentic and so passionate about the local area. We hope she can bring her energy and enthusiasm for making life better for her constituents.
Accompanied by two Green MPs, she was sworn in as an MP in the Commons on Monday. And this bit is not important at all, but her coloured suit was amazing.
So recent Sky News and YouGov polling carried out after last week's by-election put the Greens in second place after Reform, ahead of Labour, who sadly had dropped to third. Obviously, it's amazing that the Greens are proving themselves to be a challenge to Labour, because those of us who have felt very disappointed by Labour might start to see Labour hopefully changing a bit of tack. Although very devastating to see Reform at the top of that poll. I think that is...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not making me feel great, that bit.
But I think if there is a silver lining to it, I think it's like the Greens in my lifetime have not really been considered a credible party, a credible alternative. And their rise is not narrativized the same way that Reform is, as this kind of like, this like juggernaut, like staggering drunkenly into British politics, absorbing people from parties as it goes. I think the Greens, by having like a slate of policies that people really respond to, are having these wins that will be much more concrete and much less, I'm hoping, less like a few years down the line, like subject to politicking and, you know, the fact that so many career politicians are kind of joining Reform. I'm hoping that good people are actually moving into the Green Party who want to make the world a better place. And that's what I think we've seen with this election.
Yeah.
And I hope to see more of it. So even though it's not as, it doesn't feel as, overblown as Reform, I don't know how Reform can sustain itself as a functioning party.
I know.
The future.
I mean, it's just nice to have a viable option that you don't feel bad about after. That you don't have to like say, I voted this way, but, and then, you know, explain the reasons. You know, you can just sort of fulsomely say, look, you know, they're authentic, they're trying to do something new. You know, people put a lot of stuff around this idea of they haven't had government before. I don't know, there is a civil service, there is, you know, people who understand how departments work. I'm feeling generally positive about it. Just on this subject though, because I really have to unburden about this. After the vote, there was all this talk about family voting. The democracy observers who were observing that election said that they saw the highest amounts of cases that they'd ever seen. And that amount of cases was 32. And it should be worth mentioning that democracy observers have seen family voting in many...
What exactly is family voting?
Family voting is where a family go into the polling booth.
And as you might expect, yeah.
And so there's a concern
to get together?
Yeah, so there's a concern that actually that's one person applying undue pressure on other family members to do that. And obviously, because we're dealing with Muslim communities, the assumption there that it's the patriarch telling the women what to do. The democracy observers didn't notify the police. I would love to see just a little bit more data and evidence about, like, you know, other, because they've seen them at many elections. I feel like essentially this observation has now snowballed and I'm having to turn on mainstream media and people essentially saying, you can't trust the Muslims. They are distorting democracy. I just find it laughable that Matt Goodwin honestly believes that if these male patriarchs didn't tell these 32 women to vote for Greens, that they would vote Reform. Yeah. I just find that absolutely laughable. If they weren't told by their like stereotypical barbaric partners to vote for the woman who is in a party led by a gay Jewish man, just Matt Goodwin, your Islamophobia doesn't make sense. Just be consistent, all right? That's all I'm saying. Just be consistent. It's that time again, by the way, listeners. We're running a mailbag episode at the start of April. So we'd love to know your questions. Maybe you want to know about my... my conspiracies, or maybe you've got a burning question about actual politics, which is what we should be answering. Please do get your questions in. You can leave them in the comments or email us at psuk@reducelistening.co.uk. And that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the UK. Sophie Duker, thank you again for being my co-host. And if our listeners want more of you, what shows do you have coming up?
I've got my show, Hot Beef Injection, which will be...
I'm still struggling to get over Hot Beef Injection.
Yes, it's called Hot Beef Injection, which I do not regret in the slightest.
Okay.
Hot Beef Injection, a show about sex and privilege, but funny, will be at the Edinburgh Fringe this year in 2026, Melbourne Comedy Festival, New York Comedy Festival. I'm taking it everywhere.
Yeah.
And you can always find me online at Sophie Jukebox.
So Hot Beef Injection, that is, you're talking about sex? Big food.
Not about big food. Not about like...
Not about ultra processed food.
No, I'm not talking about stock. I am talking about bat shots. I'm talking about sex.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You seem to be like quite existentially disturbed by Hot Beef Injection.
I know I'm never going to forget it now. And now I have to.
Not everyone experiences Hot Beef Injection. It could be, you know, a lukewarm chipolata, however you like to make love.
Okay. We're very open here on this show. We're very sex positive. Hot Beef
Injection. Hot Beef Injection also has made it to Pod Save the UK.
Also, follow at Podsave the UK on Instagram, TikTok, X and Blue Sky. That way you won't miss any of us. And yeah, Podsave the UK, it's a reduced listing production for Crooked Media. Bet you didn't know that.
I do, because I've listened to the pod before, as I'm sure most of the listeners have. And they will know that it is all thanks to lead producer May Robson and digital producer Jacob Liebenberg.
But would they really know that the theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos?
They might not remember that, but they certainly do remember that the engineer, who is wonderful, is Jeet Basani, and our social media producer is Nada Smiljanic.
Well, brownie points for anyone that remembers the executive producers, who are Kate Fitzsimons and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And remember,
a hot beef injection for those who subscribe.
A hot beef injection for every subscriber. And you can also get, as well as that lovely meaty insertion, new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. We don't kink shame.
We don't kink shame. I do, yes.
Good news. Goodwill Columbus has opened a new store in Westerville. And with a new donation center, it's easier than ever to make a difference in your community. Bring your gently used clothing, furniture, electronics, and more to our donation drop-off. Each donation and purchase supports our mission to provide jobs, free job training, essential services, and more right here in Westerville. Drop your donations off at 60 East Schrock Road or learn more at goodwillcolumbus.org.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural, because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
A burst pipe. A dead water heater. The AC calling it quits. Who do you call? HomeServe is an easy way to handle unexpected home repairs, with plans covering stuff basic homeowners insurance usually won't. Instead of scrambling for a contractor, you make one call to get the repair process started. Join the millions of customers who trust HomeServe right now. Go to homeserve.com/podcast for 50% less your first year. That's homeserve.com/podcast. Savings compared to renewal price. Void in Florida.